Tim and I have both been talking recently about Bendoa, which is a text by Dogen that was written in the 13th century. And the reason we've been talking about it a lot is that we have a study group going right now. And it's a text that we both really like. And now it's kind of at the top of our heads. So we've been talking about it. I talked about it, 3 weeks ago, I think, and then he talked about it the week after, and maybe before, too. So anyway, more Bendoa today. I want to give a little bit of quick background in case you haven't heard the other talks. This is a text that Dogen wrote. He was a monk who was the person who brought Soto Zen, our style of Zen, from China into Japan. Zen had already been in Japan for hundreds of years, but he brought a new way of practicing Zen, a unique way, into Japan. He went to China with his teacher in search of the real teachings. He really felt like he hadn't gotten them in Japan. And he found them eventually and studied there with a master for a number of years. And while he was, and then he came back to Japan to the monastery that he had left from. And while he was gone, conditions had really deteriorated and the monastery was in, you know, it was in near chaos. The priests weren't practicing in any kind of way that they should have been. They were really concerned with status and luxury and, you know, all the trappings and things, but not in the real spiritual development that they should have been working on. So he was aghast. And after a little while, he left that temple and was on his own for a while. Actually, he needed permission from the government to open a new school, and he hadn't gotten it yet, so he spent a couple of years sort of in between there. The first thing, and he spent the whole rest of his life writing, and so he left this huge volume of work. The first thing he wrote was Fukan Zazengi, which is really Dogen in a nutshell. It's sort of the essential Dogen. And it's pretty short, and we used to chant it here in the evening just before we went to bed when we were in retreat. So it's in our chant book if you ever want to look at it. It's in the back of our chant book here somewhere. But it it's instructions for how to do zazen. And it's very detailed, and I'm not finding it. Anyway, it's back in the back of most of these somewhere. But it's very detailed. It's got the mystical element to it, and then it's also got the practical. Here's the way you hold your hands, you know. So it's sort of Dogen's opening salvo against these monks who were really not practicing in the way that they should have been. And then the second thing... Ah, there it is. So the second thing... So universal recommendations for Zazengi. And it's about almost 2 pages long. It's a really good thing to chant because then you really get it in your bones. And when you read, you run across the phrases from this one all over the place in Zen writings. And so you can see how much of it gets traced back to this one chant. So then the next thing that he wrote after that was Bendoa. And Bendoa means talk on the wholehearted practice of the way. So it started out as a talk, and it got transcribed. And some people say that it's the opening chapter of his Shobogenzo, which was his life's masterwork. But other scholars say that it isn't, that it stands on its own. And from what I've read, I'm kind of in that camp, although in one way it doesn't really matter. So he wrote Bendoa, and then he founded another, another monastery. And then his main lifelong disciple, Kōun Eijo, shows up. And Kōun Eijo was a little bit older than him. He was a very accomplished monk. He had been studying with Tenzai masters, and so he knew a particular way of Buddhism. I think he'd also studied in Pure Land. But when he met Dogen, he saw that here was somebody who really had something new going on. And so he stayed and studied with Dogen. And I wanted to also show you in our chat book, on Saturday mornings we chant the list of Zen ancestors. It's one of my favorite things. Starting all the way from Buddha and going down, you know, he passed the Dharma to so-and-so, to so-and-so, and so-and-so, all the way through the Indian ancestors, and then all the way through the Chinese ancestors. And then we get here, and we get great teacher Eihei Dogen, and in Japan. So the Chinese master that he learned it from was Tiantong Ruzhing. Then we chant great teacher Eihei Dogen, and then great teacher Ko-un Ajo. So when I see these names, it's nice. Having been here on Saturdays, I can go, I know that name. And sometimes I can even say, he's right before or after, or she's right before or after. But anyway, so Ko-un Ajo is on our list. So he joined the community, and now I want to talk about this book. So he opens the book with sort of, he's setting the ground, and he kind of gives an executive summary, sort of, in which he says, one of the things that he says is, Buddhas together transmitting Dharma and actualizing unsurpassed complete enlightenment. Buddhas together are transmitting Dharma and they're actualizing unsurpassed complete enlightenment. So he's definitely a mystic, you know. I mean, it's a very religious sounding thing. There's a book about Dogen called Mystical Realist, and I think that's the best description of him, because he has this really big mystical side, and then he's also extraordinarily down to earth. It's one of the things I like about him. So Buddhas together, we're talking about all the Buddhas, you know, in the past, the present, the future, throughout space and time, all the Buddhas. And that's the way that it's a very mystical thing to say. And he says, we do this too in Jijyu Samadhi, in self-fulfilling samadhi. So from this very body, from this very perspective, we do the same thing. We could do the same thing. We do it, we just don't see that we're doing it. And the method for doing that, he says, is zazen. It's zazen. So once he gets done laying that groundwork, then he spends some time talking about his trip to China and what he learned and what happened. And then, after he's done doing that, he really opens it up. He really opens it up. He talks about how if we truly sit in zazen, we can wake up so that we can see that we are spending our lives in Indra's net. And Indra's net is a metaphor that comes out of Huayan Buddhism that visualizes the universe as a net, this huge net, and at each intersection of the strings in the net, there's a jewel, and each jewel reflects back endlessly all the other jewels in the net. So this net goes throughout space and time. There are all these jewels in it, reflecting each other, depending on each other. The whole thing is sort of quivering in that way, and we are the jewels, of course. So Indra's net is a really nice metaphor when we lose track of the fact that we aren't the bump in the universe, that there isn't the universe and then us. You know, you can think of yourself as one of those little gems in Indra's net. So he starts talking about how sitting in zazen can wake us up so we can rest in that. And he talks about how the whole world is just resonating together. Everything is arising and falling together. I had a boss, Jesus was 25 years ago now, I worked in a big giant corporation, and I worked in the marketing research department. And I had this great boss who one day talked about our department. He said, you know, in this big, huge corporation, most people who work here are really kind of sitting at their desks all day, sort of scribbling. You know, they're like this. And they're working on very narrow pieces of what goes on in this industry and in this company. And he said, but in our particular area, we have a chance to, because of what we do and the way that we work, we get to look up and we can see over the waves, you know. Meanwhile, everybody else is kind of down in these little rowboats or something, and the waves are all like this, and they don't get to really see what's going on above the waves. And I call him Zen Master Stewart now. He was my first Zen Master. But, you know, I was reminded of that when I first read this, because I thought this is a practice that helps us look up over the waves, you know, to see that there's this huge ocean out there, and we're not just, you know, in some rowboat that's bobbing with waves like this all around us so that we can't see anything. There are all kinds of wave and ocean metaphors in Zen. There's one about swimming at the top of the ocean while your feet are walking on the ocean floor. I like that one a lot. I don't remember where that one came from, but it sounds very Dogen, because it's keep your feet on the floor, keep yourself grounded, and at the same time, you're swimming at the top of the ocean. Very nice. So that's the kind of thing that he's talking about here. But, you know, when we talk about practice between each other, you know, and we do endlessly, we're very boring that way, how's your practice going? You know, and what people will inevitably say to you is, oh, I sat for 20 minutes this morning, or, well, I didn't sit at all this week, or I sat, you know, 2 hours a day, but I was distracted the whole thing. You know, they'll tell you things about their meditation if you ask people about their practice. And you know, and we think about our practice as a thing, or we think about it as something that we use to reach some goal. But that's not what it is. There's a, let me see, Stephen Batchelor in Verses from the Center, Morning Study Group was doing Verses from the Center. I had a really hard time this week because I had so much I wanted to talk about from both of the study groups. But in here, Stephen Batchelor says, rather than representing a doorway that opens to a mystical transcendent sphere hidden beneath the surface of everyday reality, emptiness merely removes the false veneer of inherent existence, thereby enabling a vision of the essential contingency of life. So what he's saying is that we have this idea that we're going to open this door and there it's going to be for us. But really a better metaphor would be if we're in this room, you know, we take down the paneling off the wall and then we see we're already there. We don't need to go opening the door and looking somewhere else. It's right here. He was talking about emptiness, which is sort of related but close, but I thought it was a good metaphor for this idea that how we sit, how we live, what we do, everything in our sort of sphere of our lives is enlightenment. It's not reaching towards enlightenment. It is enlightenment. And I think that's something that we can't say often enough, because we hear it and we hear it and we hear it and we maybe even believe it and believe it and believe it, but it's very slippery and it's hard to stay with it and it's hard to remember it during the tough times. So let me see. So he talks about, so he sort of opens things wide up with that section of the book. And then there's one sentence on page 23 that I really liked. So he's going along talking about, you know, all this sort of mystical opening up, all these influences and things. And then he says, however, these various mutual influences do not mix into the perceptions of this person sitting, because they take place within stillness without any fabrication, and they are enlightenment itself. So we sit ourselves down on the cushion, and we sit down and we think, okay, Dogen says that this right here is Buddha. So I am sitting here with all the Buddhas, and this is it, you know. And then Dogen comes along and says, but all of that stuff doesn't mix into the perception of the person sitting, because it all takes place within stillness. So, you know, we hear all the stuff about sitting like a Buddha, sitting with our hair on fire. We sit down, and then we have to let go of all that, too. It's the thing I like best about Zen. You know, you get all these ideas built up, and then you sit down, and the first thing you do, you know, is you sort of kick your chair out from under yourself. So, because if you sit there like that, you're going to immediately go into grandiosity. You know, I am sitting on the Buddha seat. This is it. Now, while all of that is true, we need to let that go and be in the silence that's underneath it, that you can find underneath it if you enter with the spirit of, I'm going to sit like this. Yeah. Since we've been studying this book, it's really helped the moment when I sit down, because I sit down on the cushion and I just feel like there's something, you know, kind of going like this. This is it. You are not just sitting facing the wall. This does not bring up visions of your childhood punishments. This is something different, you know. This is actualizing, you know, this is actualizing Buddha right here, what you're doing. And it kind of gets me ready. But then you have to let go of that and just let it happen. Okay? So we don't go off on a trip about that. We just kind of exist in that awareness. And then he closes the main part of the Bendoa talking about the effects of Zen practice. And with an encouragement to sit. And then there is a series of questions and answers, and there are 18 of them. And the scholarly speculation about them is that they weren't questions that came from the audience of monks that he originally gave this talk to, but that later when Ko'un Ajo joined him, that these were Ko'un Ajo's questions, because they're these very astute questions that come at what he's just said from about 100 different directions, and they're the kind of questions that would come from a very experienced monk who is really interested in what you've said, but what you've said has just sort of blown their head off, and contradicted a lot of what they've already learned. So he's really, you know, trying to pin Dogen down, trying to say, but what about this? But what about that? So he's got these great questions. And four of them in particular are questions that could have been asked by any one of us last week. And so I want to run through them really quickly, but then talk about those four. You know, he asked questions like, why do you recommend only Zazen as a Dharma gate? And then why is this one the only true gate? How can sitting vainly without doing anything be a means for attaining enlightenment? You know, kind of an on and on and on. This is one of the six paramitas. Why do you say the true Dharma is consolidated in this one practice? Why sitting? You know, why not lying down or, you know, jogging around the lake? Why I like this one. Why did the early masters only bring the intellectual teachings back from China and put aside Zazen? It's almost a who do you think you are question. Did they comprehend the Dharma? You know. Do those who focus on Zazen still need to observe the precepts strictly? The answer to that was yes. Can you combine Zazen with other practices? At that time, there were a lot of practices like chanting the name of Buddha and different things. And Dogen is trying to get them to just sit. Oh, here's another good. What about the people who awoke after hearing the sound of bamboo or seeing the color of blossoms? Even Buddha awoke when seeing the morning star. Were they definitely only people who had engaged in Zazen? So we have all these stories about somebody who hears the sound of the bamboo and becomes enlightened. And what about them? So Dogen has answers for all of them. But the four that I wanted to point out, question 13, and I've distilled these down. These are really long questions. Can this practice be carried out by laymen and laywomen or just by monks? And, of course, in that day, and from what I understand in modern-day Japan, too, a lot of the practice is carried out by monks. And the lay people don't, you wouldn't find a place where, or too many places, where lay people come together and sit in meditation. So I think that was a large part of his question. But the other one is, can men and the other part of the question in there is, can men and women both do this, both become enlightened? And this seems like a really obvious question to us, but it wasn't, I guess, obvious to him. And unlike a lot of other monasteries in Japan at that time, Dogen had nuns also as disciples, as students there, including a couple who were very close to him. And I went and looked them up this week, who they were. And one of them was Ryonin Geisho, who is another one who we chant in our Saturday morning services. As soon as I saw that name, Ryonin, if you chant these services every week, I went, is that Ryonin Geisho? You know, the way that we chant. Just before Vaidehi Vasati Ubi. So Ryonin Geisho. No, right before Kojima Kendo. So Ryonin Geisho was in here. She's one of the ancestors that we chant. And she was older before she was ordained. She was ordained elsewhere and then came to study with Dogen. And he mentioned her accomplishments in at least one of his Dharma talks. In one of his books, he praised her. And she was also praised by other prominent Zen masters of the day. So she was quite something. And she died quite a while before Dogen. The other one that gets mentioned is Egi, who was ordained as a Daruma Shu nun. And I meant to look up what that was because I had never heard that before. But Daruma means Dharma. Like in Japanese, instead of saying Bodhidharma, they say Bodhi Daruma. So Daruma Shu, I'm thinking we're Soto Shu, that must have been the Dharma school. So anyway, she was ordained as a Daruma Shu nun, but she joined Dogen at Eheiji at his last teaching temple. And she spent over 20 years working with him closely. And she presided over his deathbed, helped him as he passed on from this life. And then afterwards, she helped Ko'u Unejo with the politics of transitioning from Dogen into the leadership of Ko'u Unejo in that monastery. So she must have been really something. She might also, there's some indication that she also was involved in the recording of at least one of his texts. Recording by hand, not recording the way we do it. Yes, and now this sounds obvious to us, but remember that we're talking 13th century Japan. Dogen wrote, "What charge is there against women? What virtue is there in man? There are wicked men in the world. There are virtuous women in the world. The desire to hear Dharma and the search for enlightenment do not necessarily rely on difference in sex." So even men can reach enlightenment if you study hard enough. I say that provisionally. We don't have to take everything on faith. I would really prefer that it be shown. The next question was, the next 13th century question was, how can people busy with their duties in the world single-mindedly practice and be in accord with the Buddha way of non-action? It just doesn't get any more contemporary than that. Because I think it's a question that we all have. I mean, how many of you have never said, oh, I'm too busy to sit today? Anybody in this room never said that? Oh, I would really like to, whatever, but I'm just too busy. And I have a lot of duties in the world. I mean, I have a hard, stressful job. I have, you know, we all have our stuff. When Dogen answered this, he talked about emperors who were, you know, very busy and stuff. And I thought, yeah, but emperors have people doing their laundry for him. Come on. Who's going to tell the emperor, no, I need you right now. You can't go sit for half an hour. But, in fact, in this world, there are a lot of people who are incarcerated, who have amazing sitting practices. I know a number of people who work with prisoners, and they talk about how these people are in noisy, kind of crazy, chaotic environments without any support whatsoever, except this occasional, you know, Buddhist priest, or in a couple of cases, I know a Catholic priest and a Lutheran guy who do this too. And these people manage in the noise. That's what I can't imagine. I can imagine busy and keeping a practice going. But constant noise? I don't know how they do that. But then I tell myself, if they can do that, and these are people who do it from a place of having to completely turn their lives around, you know, if they can do that, you know, surely we can. I've also read lately a couple of articles by men, and these are by men in the military who have developed sitting practices. One was in Iraq, and then there was another one who I think was working in the Pentagon and started a meditation group. And, you know, you might say that this is impossible for warriors, or maybe they should just get out of the military and then start the practice or something, but I would say, you know, it makes me happy that, you know, that we have this military, that, you know, if we're going to have this military, that there are people in it who are practicing the Dharma, you know? I mean, maybe someday we really will have a Department of Defense instead of the Department of War that we currently seem to have. I used to work for a dot-com back in the dot-com days. And that was a pretty chaotic place. And it was you know, it was very easy to kind of get wrapped around the axle there. And by the time I started working there, I had been sitting and studying for several years. And it was really helpful to me to be able to just every so often stop and say, this place is a Buddha field, you know? This place is a Buddha field. And some client was, you know, just going ballistic on you, and everything that you had done for the last 3 weeks had to be thrown away, and something new had to be done, and it had to be done in 3 days. I don't know how I would have been able to work there if I hadn't thought of that as a Buddha field. And as a practice place. Speaking of criminals, I meant to mention Tonan O'Connor, who's coming here next week, is one of those Buddhist priests who works in prisons. She goes out to a number of prisons in Wisconsin, and works with those folks. And she's coming here next week. She's going to give the talk, and then she's also giving a workshop. And her workshop is on compassion, and she's going to be using Dogen's writings as a basis for the workshop. So I think the combination of her background working with prisoners and working with the prison system and Dogen, putting those two pieces of her background together with the topic of compassion is going to be really interesting. So I thought I'd mention that while I was in there. So how can people busy with their duties in the world single-mindedly practice? And I'll tell you the place where I really, really learned how to do this was during retreats when we did work practice. Because it really showed me how to not only work mindfully, but do whichever job I was assigned to, and I would try really hard to just take a job without having some preference about it. I would always have a preference about it, but I would try really hard not to show it so that I would get, you know, just some random job. So it taught me a lot about how to, I don't like dusting, and how to make dusting, the time that I'm spend dusting isn't time outside of my life. It isn't sort of this blank spot in my life. Okay, now I'm going to go dust, and then I will have it gotten over with, and then my life can start again. And you know, I was in my 40s. It was about time I learned this. But and I used to say, could I bring my teenage kids here to learn how to do this? But it was a real revelation to me, and it changed the way that that I could get myself to do other kinds of work. I don't always manage it, but if there's something that I really don't want to do, or some kind of work that's really stressing me out, or something, some part of work that I really hate and try to avoid, you know, I'll just give myself a little Buddha talk. Maybe you could do this like the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And actually you can. So work practice. Just happened to mention that since we have work practice this afternoon. Thought I'd slip that one in. So it's an ad, but it's also true. It's also true. Sometimes I think, you know, I've learned so much from studying the teachings, and I've learned so much from Zazen, and it's become actualized when in things like work practice and sewing practice and cooking in the kitchen and things like that. That's where the teachings come to life, if you can see them happening in your life. You know, I mean, who cares if you can see them happening on the cushion? You know, if you get up and walk out the door and nothing's changed, well, how nice for you. You had a half an hour that was nice in your life. But, so, question 15 is, is it possible to attain enlightenment through this practice even in this corrupt, declining age? And the background on that was that at the time, they thought that they were in the age of the degenerate Dharma. Somebody, I don't know who, came up with this notion of the first 500 years after the Buddha died was the age of the true Dharma, or the right Dharma, where everything was being correctly practiced, correctly transmitted. And then for the next 500 to 1,000 years would be the age of the semblance Dharma, or the imitative Dharma, where the practice was there but only as a form, so it was kind of dead. But nobody attained enlightenment. And then after that, the last age was the age of the degenerate Dharma, or the last Dharma. And in that age, nobody practices. The only thing that stayed is the teachings. And in Dogen's time, they believed that they were in that age. And I'll bet if you asked a representative sample of American Zen students, they would say that we're in that age. I mean, I've said this myself, you know, that coming to the U.S. was a big mistake. This is where Dharma came to die. You know, take a look at any of the glossy Dharma magazines, and there'll be fabulous, fabulous articles in them, and then you start looking at the ads, and you go, oh my God, we're doomed. You know, this is it. You know, Dharma dating services, Dharma financial planners, you know, Dharma crap, Dharma this. And just the way that this society kind of trivializes things. If you go to a movie, any kind of mainstream movie, and the scene is in a character's house, if there's a Buddha in that character's house, have you noticed that this is a shorthand way to say this person is a New Age nut and kind of obnoxious? Have you noticed that? I see a Buddha in a character's house in a movie, and I go, oh, no, 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 no. I want to stand up and say, we're not like that. We're not like that. This is some director's set director's way of, you know, telegraphing to you something. But anyway, everybody thinks they're in the declining age. But, you know, there is, just like there is no intrinsic self-nature ascribed to each one of us, you know, I'm not a bad girl, I'm not a nice girl, I'm not a good priest, I'm not a bad priest. Ages are the same way. There's no degenerate age, there's no age of the right Dharma. Those are all just labels that we put on them. And every age in the world is just Dharma, you know? It's arising and abiding and passing away in every moment. And there's opportunities in every age. In fact, in difficult ages are times when a lot of times really amazing things happen. It's like the lotus growing out of the muck, out of the dirty water. You know, they can be difficult times can be the catalyst for wonderful things to happen because people realize we really need to make them happen. And then the last question, this is the last of his questions and the last one that I'm going to talk about. And I've left more of it in because I just love it. In our country, from ancient times, people have lacked benevolence and wisdom. So shouldn't we regret that because of being barbarians, it is difficult for us to grow the true seed? Also, home-leaving monks in this country are inferior even to lay people of those great countries, which gives you an idea of what Ko and Ajo felt about monks and lay people. Even our monks are worse than their lay people. Everybody here is stupid and narrow-minded. They deeply cling to artificial merits and admire superficial virtues. Even if such people do zazen, how could they actually achieve enlightenment? I think I read this article in Tricycle magazine. I think that, you know, that we are asking the same kind of questions. You know? Especially when I read the part about deeply clinging to artificial merits and admiring superficial virtues. You know? So we live right in the middle of ground zero of artificial merits and superficial virtues, I think. But Dogen says, actualizing and entering Buddha Dharma, or sailing beyond illusion, don't you like that, sailing beyond illusion, does not necessarily depend on the intelligence of the human and heavenly realms. And this echoes something that he said in Fukan Zazengi, where he said, intelligence or lack of it does not matter. Between the dull and the sharp-witted, there is no distinction. And so I think that it also follows that no matter what kind of age we're in, no matter what we're surrounded by, the important thing is that this inconceivable Dharma that he talks about is here. It's arising in every moment. It's available to each one of us, and it's not actualized without our practice. So what it's dependent on is not our being bright, it's not our being holy, it's not our being totally without flaws or without without desires even, you know. What it's dependent on is whether we practice, whether we work at it. This reminded me of a chant that I used to say every morning. I had this morning service that I did for a long time, and I really need to start doing it again because I really liked it. But part of it was a chant called Eternal Peace Inspirational Vow. And one line in it that really was inspirational for me was, it said, before Buddhas were enlightened, they were the same as we. Enlightened people of today are exactly as those of old. Before Buddhas were enlightened, they were the same as we. Enlightened people of today are exactly as those of old. I think Dogen would have a little quibble of with this, and I do too. Before Buddhas were enlightened? Before they were enlightened? Weren't we all originally enlightened? But what he's saying there is, Buddhas throughout space and time, even going back the seven Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha, Vipassana Buddha, Shikin Buddha, Vishabhu Buddha, Krakuchanda Buddha, Kanakamuni Buddha, Kashyapa Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, all of those folks were the same as we. And enlightened people of today aren't like second-class sort of enlightened citizens. We're enlightened people of today. And it's all dependent on whether we want to open our eyes and see it. That's all I'm going to say. Anybody else want to say? Any other enlightened beings want to say anything to add to that? Sure, you laugh. We say we believe this stuff, and then we laugh. You don't have to believe this stuff. I'd ask you to have a little bit of faith in it. And if you can't muster up faith, have a little hope. But please don't believe it until you have some experience of it. And come here and sit and you'll have some experience of it. Or sit at home. Or sit with another group. Just do it.
I have a question.
Alrighty.
What did Dogen say when he was asked by the monk whether you could practice other, have other practices and still practice Sangha?
He said, you know, kind of, he went back to this is the one true way. This is how you should be practicing. And I don't remember if he actually said, no, don't do those, but he said, he kind of indicated that they were, why waste your time was sort of the implication that I got out of it. And I think that he was just really, really trying to get people to do this one thing and not spread themselves out too thin, doing all kinds of other practices. Because there were just a bazillion of them. And I think it's really easy to have this kind of horizontal spirituality where you dig each, you know, you dig 100 holes that are like this deep, and it's so much better, I think, to dig one really deep hole and then jump in it. And then jump in it. Yeah.
Dogen say in response to the question regarding awakening outside of the structure of practice, referencing the sound of the bamboo something.
Yeah. Let me see here. Number 17. Mm-hmm. His very short answer, you should know that through the ages, those who clarified mind by seeing colors or actualized the way by hearing sounds were each the exact person who exerted the way without vacillating deliberation. And right away, they had no secondary person or dualistic being. So those people who clarified the mind those ways were each the exact person who exerted the way without deliberation. So so he was saying yes to the question. The question was, were they definitely only people who had engaged the way of Zazen? And his answer is yes, they did Zazen practice beforehand. You know, Wei Ning, the sixth ancestor, was an illiterate. I forget what he did. Did he gather firewood gatherers, Susan? Is that what Wei Ning did, I think, before he went to the monastery? Something like that. Yeah. And he was awakened in his hometown before he went to the monastery by hearing somebody recite the Diamond Sutra. And this is the story. And one of the explanations I've heard about how that could be so, given the Dogen point of view, was that in a previous life, he must have had a really serious Zazen practice. So we have our ways of making our arguments fit any circumstance. I just say that because the sixth ancestor story is a very stirring story, and big parts of it maybe didn't happen exactly as it's written down. And scholars acknowledge that, so it's okay. I'm not spouting heresy. I'm not worried about the falling down. Like that. Larry, yeah,
that's
funny.
Yeah, I want to say something about that comment. Dogen said about having an exclusive method. And I read that in the Federal Tour, I was kind of surprised at that. I know Tianlis said that it's possible to have many teachers during life and learn from many sources. I always believe that too, that mm-hmm. you can learn from a lot of different teachers and a lot of different things, you know, that aren't teachers.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think it's true. And, you know, even while I say, you know, that, I'm not sure, I don't have one in my pocket. Even though I say, you know, build one hole and stay in it, you know, I've almost always got a mala in my pocket. And that's not a Zen practice, carrying malas around and having little beads and things like that. So I think it doesn't, you know, I don't think you need to shut yourself off to other teachers. I mean, Ko and Ajo, look at him. He studied in three different forms. And Dogen, too. He started off as Tendai, right? As Tendai. One of the early teachers that I sat with was a woman named Yvonne Rand, who had attended Suzuki Roshi at his deathbed, and she became a priest, and she's a Zen priest and quite an amazing Zen teacher. But she also has had a number of Tibetan teachers that she's been very close to, and so but they told her when she started studying with them, keep your Zen roots, you know, don't sort of throw that over. They could see that she had very strong roots in one tradition. And they said, you know, study with us. We're happy to have you. And keep those roots. So, I think it's possible to find a middle way. But don't let that middle way be a field that has 100 shallow holes in it. Exactly. You know, there's so much one true way in the world, you know. I mean, you don't want to be too kind of one true way about it. But on the other hand, be one true way about it. I believe both. And probably something else that contradicts it.
Early on, you were talking about, you know, how's your practice going? And I, in some ways, I always kind of cringe at that question because I feel like it makes it, people connote it as, how's your zazen going? Mm-hmm. And I really, in some way, like to throw that question out the window and say, how's your life going?
How's your life going? That's right.
Because there's not a difference. So, I think that Dogen really was a lot about, you know, everyday things.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think in Kukanza Zengi, he talks about the everyday things. So, I can't just sit on this cushion and then go. And if you're in this practice, is to take what happens on the cushion and take it with you for your whole day. And it's only, not that I am so great at it, but I try. But you know, it's like taking what we're doing here and trying to live it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's
you're saying actualize.
Yeah. And that's the quote on the bulletin today. Rich. When my master and I were walking in the rain, he would say, "Do not walk so fast. The rain is everywhere." You know. I think of Dharma rain, you know, you walk in the mist. And pretty soon, and you think nothing's happening, and pretty soon you're wet. And you go, how did that happen? But also, you know, when it's raining, when it's raining in your life, don't try to get out of the rain. Just do what you can in the rain. Work with the rain. And if working with the rain means putting up your umbrella, you know, great. But just don't try to get out of the rain. Just take care of your life. Yeah.
As little kids, we have endless arguments. We have a lot of time in our hands. In the summer, we argue about the rain. And it would go like this. Would you get wetter if you ran through the rain? Would you hit more drops? Or if you go slow and dodge the rain, and you spend more time out there, but you miss more. And we each have our theory and arguments. And I was just so pleased to see that.
Was that argument ever resolved about whether to? I want to say it into the mic so we're sure we got it. The childhood argument of whether you should run in the rain because then you'll go through more of it and you'll get more drops on you.
Yeah, but
a shorter amount of time. Or whether you should walk and maybe miss some of the drops. And yeah. So was it resolved at some point, or was this just an ongoing childhood discussion that now you can think about all afternoon today and still wonder about? Yeah. That's wonderful. Thank you.